Cordes, good morning to you. And Ms. Vincent, good morning to you. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Cordes, you may proceed. Both sides have up to 20 minutes for arguments.
May it please this honorable court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Deshaun Gleaton is the appellant in this case, and my name is Robert Cordes. I'm with the Commission on Public Advocacy, and I represent Mr. Gleaton, who's been convicted of first-degree murder and other related charges out of a homicide that occurred in July of 2020. In respect to the assignments of error, I'm ultimately going to ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial, and upon certain conditions, as an alternative, to sentencing errors require new sentencing for the non-homicide offenses, depending on how the other issues are resolved. The first assignment of error is a Daubert-Schaeferman's challenge. And in this case, it boils down to just one of the factors of Daubert. The court ruled that whether a theory or technique can be read, can be, and has been tested, was a factor it was going to consider that. And it considered it through a convergence of two theories. One is that the testing and the methodology used by Mr. Hurley was repeatable and reliable. And the second is that he used a methodology. And it is the position of the defense that there is an abuse of discretion there. And it's because that just didn't happen as far as the repeatable and reliable. The judge relied on two prior cases involving a real tool time data. And one of those was the Aubrey Trail case. And in that case, you had a single cell phone tower out in rural Nebraska with a single highway that went through that area. And the officer was able to calculate the number of times the things hit off the tower and the distance, and it was fairly easy. One road, easy stops identified, and was able to pinpoint those things. But he used calculations that he himself did, and he didn't use PenLink. The second case was a homicide also in the rural area of Nebraska, and in that case it was Derek Olson was one of the defendants in that case. And again, we have very few towers that we're dealing with, and very few points of intersection with that towers, and so the computations are different. But also in that case, Mr. Hurley didn't use any methodology. He didn't participate in that, okay, and PenLink wasn't used. And so we get to this case. We have Investigator Hurley using PenLink data, which wasn't used in Aubrey Trail's case, and wasn't used in Olson's case, and now we're gifting that perceived methodology with reliability and repeated authenticity, if you will. And that is an abuse of discretion. So in neither instance was it true that it was repeated. In neither instance was it true that the method used in this case was reliable. But it's what the court relied
on. What does PenLink do?
PenLink is, oh, or to,
in your case, allegedly do.
Okay. In this case, the thought was that the cell phone company keeps records, and it keeps records for its own purposes, for billing purposes, for people who are on pay-as-you-go plans. And so it keeps the data from the cell phone tower to the handset, mm-hmm. that or cell phone that's being used. And so it could be an application. It could be a phone call, but every time there's a communication between the tower and that handset, there's a number of sets of data that's collected. And what happens is Verizon, for instance, the companies that collect that data, supply that data to law enforcement. And then law enforcement would supply that data to PenLink. And there's a computation that goes on in PenLink. They use computer programs to ascertain the data, and they take that data and they put it with PenLink on an arc. You probably are used to seeing the pie shape with cell phone data, but PenLink would use an arc. And then for trial, we convert that arc back to wedge shape pie shapes.
But, you know, in Simmer, when you have DNA, which is a an established, Daubert, reliable thing, but when you get to other processes that are calculating that data and putting it into a way that's going to be presented to the jury, we still go through the Daubert analysis to see if it's working, see if it meets those five factors. And we did something like that in this case. We did it with Investigator Hurley's computations of that data. And in this case, the judge just made a findings of fact that these were reliable and repeatable, and that it was a process and methodology used before, and that's just not true.
I mean, was the raw data available to the parties?
You know, I believe so. I believe that the data was available to the parties. I don't think anybody was questioning the authenticity or the accuracy of the data supplied by Verizon.
The question I'm getting to is, how is this different than doing long division? You can do long division on paper and come up with an answer if you have all the numbers, or you can use a calculator. Well, but you don't know how the calculator necessarily works to get there, but it comes to the same answer. How is this different than that?
Well, what's remarkable about your question is the curiosity. How is it working? How is it working? We don't know, because there's no record of that here. And there should have been. There should have been an examination of how PennLink is using this data, how Investigator Hurley has used that PennLink data before, or the computation method, and it wasn't. So what we have is an understanding that cell phone tower data is something that's familiar with courts. It's been accepted in the past under other circumstances. The FBI has a program for doing the database and getting those similar types of computations. And then we're just going to let it in. And what happened was we needed a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper should have expanded and explored how that PennLink does it and whether it's reliable. And so you have all these other factors to test reliability. And none of these other factors are going to that. There's no peer review. There's no acceptance in the scientific community. There's no...
Before you go on, to strain my oversimplified example a little bit further, if you have the raw data yourself, isn't it possible to check your numbers, to check the results just by doing that or obtaining an expert to do it for you?
You ask for something that is beyond my expertise, and that's kind of the point. This is also beyond a layperson's expertise. It's beyond the juror's expertise, and so it isn't scientific evidence, but it is something that is specialized or technical knowledge, and it is something that belongs under the auspices of a gatekeeper's function to determine whether or not the jury should hear it.
What did the RTT data show, or what did the state use it to attempt to show?
In this case, Your Honor, the state attempted to lend credibility to the witness's testimony that established the whereabouts of the decedent, Haley Christensen, on the night before she died. So she was out drinking with a number of people at a bar, and then they went to an after-hours party. And so there was also testimony about calls being made between the appellant and the decedent or the decedent's friends. And so this data was used to say, hey, these witnesses are saying they were with Haley Christensen, and these are the things she said, and this is what we observed on the phone. They must be right, because we can use those handsets and can believe that the handset that has Christensen's phone number is probably in Haley Christensen's possession. We can believe that the handset that was with Deshaun Gleaton's phone number might have been in his possession, and from there draw the conclusion that when they testify to these occurrences, that they are accurate.
But wasn't it used to show that Gleaton was in the vicinity of Christensen's house at the time the shooting occurs? And don't we have all kinds of other evidence of that? I mean, what's the prejudicial nature of this RTT data? Is it anything beyond this theory that it somehow lent credibility to other evidence?
In the first instance, you are correct. It was used to lend to the jury the proposition that there's scientific evidence to back the presence of Mr. Gleaton in the vicinity of Haley Christensen's residence. And you are absolutely right that there is other evidence to establish that.
His own confessions.
There is other evidence to establish that, including statements. Now, his statements are a mixed bag. They're also retractions of that, Your Honor. But I imagine if you took and cherry-picked the worst of his statements, you'd come to that conclusion. But it isn't just a theory that the evidence was used for other purposes. And it isn't just a theory that those other purposes had a harmful effect on the case. They were used to go to those witnesses who were obviously drunk or stoned and had testimony different from the other witnesses about the events of the night, including who was there, how much they were drinking, and whether or not they could ever get stoned from marijuana use. And so when you take the problems that the prosecutor was having with those witnesses, and you say, oh no, we have science, we have technology to back that some of what they must be saying is true, then it isn't just a theory of that it might have a harmful effect. It was used for that purpose, to establish credibility in witnesses that had some credibility issues.
Did the next door neighbor see a vehicle that she believed was usually driven by Mr. Gleaton, and did she see him climb over the fence to the back of the house?
Yes.
Am I remembering that correctly?
You're remembering that accurately, Your Honor.
And was there questions about her sobriety or level of intoxication at 6:30 in the morning or whatever time it was?
Your Honor, there was not. There was a question about her identification of Mr. Gleaton as a person that was crossing the fence. At one point, she said she didn't know, and at the other point, she recognized it as a person of color that she knew from previous time. But yeah, there's no question she places him in there, in the back of the house going in that morning. And the handset testimony wasn't used in that respect, but there was no testimony about her cell phone number or handset number and Mr. Gleaton's.
Thank you.
So I would like to now turn...
Do you have any authority that supports this theory for why the error is prejudicial, because the evidence lent credibility? Do you have any authority to support that argument?
I mean, do I have a case that is similar to that?
Yeah.
I do not, Judge. Turning to the misconduct, I want to begin, before I deal with the actual issues, with some concepts of dilution and hopeless piety, because we're dealing again with prosecutorial misconduct. And one of the definitions of dilution is that it includes the action of making something weaker in force, content, or value. And I bring that up because I see a problem declaring something improper, then having no meaningful remedy. And what happens over time is the dilution of the reasons for calling something improper in the first place. And I have the audacity today to bring to this court a dissenting opinion in the United States Supreme Court, which, quoting a dissenting opinion from another justice, that was 40 years before that. So the dissenting opinion that I want to quote from involves hopeless piety. And it's from Justice Blackmun in Darden versus Wainwright, 477 U.S., 168. This is a 1986 case. And he's talking about the second time in that term that the court has found misconduct during summation, and yet the conviction is not going to be reversed. And so he turns to Justice Jerome Frank from 40 years previously, who had penned these comments. This court has several times used vigorous language in denouncing government counsel for such conduct as that of the prosecutor here, but each time it has said that nevertheless it would not reverse. Such an attitude of helpless piety is, I think, undesirable. It means actual condemnation of counsel's alleged offense, coupled with verbal disprobation. If we continue to do nothing practical to prevent such conduct, we would cease to disprove it. For otherwise, it will be as if we declared in effect, government attorneys, without fear of reversal, may say just about what they please in addressing juries.
You seem to have jumped to whether any misconduct should require reversal, but do you have an argument as to whether this was misconduct at all? Do you want to start there?
I can. I would just, with the justice completing that, he talks about the disapproving the remarks and not punishing them. It's basically encouraging people to do that, and that prosecutors are willing to take their verbal spanking in court.
What was improper about these remarks?
Each of those remarks were improper. Each of those remarks were reversible. And the first remark...
Can you refresh my memory? What were the remarks in this case?
The first assignment of error relating to prosecutorial misconduct goes to comments by the prosecutor to the jury that there's a social contract out there involving crime, and that justice requires them to...
Why would that possibly be misconduct?
It's misconduct because social contract theories like that have been, as I've cited, to the cases where it has been reversed. And what we're looking at is because you're asking the jury to look at sending a message to show justice instead of taking an unbiased look at the facts and applying the law to those facts to come to a conclusion. So when you ask the jury or reminding them about social justice and the need to invoke justice to send a message to the community.
Did the prosecutor ever say, send a message?
This is what the prosecutor said, Your Honor. The rules are you don't kill folk. You particularly don't kill folk in this manner. If you do, we have a hire, you know. We drag people to see if you broke the contract. Objection and overruled.
Isn't that true? We have laws that prohibit murder and trials to figure out if someone committed it.
Your Honor, he goes on after the objection's overruled. This is the basis of law, and the argument for the basis of law is a social contract. Who breaks it and who doesn't? Everybody. It's not just the family or the state or the defendant. Just verdicts are set up for everybody. That's the invitation to apply their job as a jury to send a message. That is what he's asked the jury to do.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But under your interpretation of this social contract, which I gather you're equating as a golden rule type argument, wouldn't Justice Jackson's opening statement to the War Crimes Tribunal following World War II violate the same principle?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what those comments were.
We're here today to punish crimes that have been recognized in every civilized society. That's not a quotation, but it's a, I think, a fairly accurate paraphrase. Isn't that essentially what the prosecutor was talking about here? Murder is recognized as a crime in every civilized society.
Your Honor, I'm going to break the components of your questions down as much as I can to answer.
Sure.
That. The first component is this a golden rule? I think when it's discussed, it's under a subheading of golden rule and social contracts, and that when you look at it more closely, there's a subheading for arguments about social contract. And it is what it is. It's an argument to the jury to send a message. Now, and to use their verdict to do that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but is it, and maybe this is helpful, and I'm sorry, Justice Castle-Litton, it is not, but are you saying this is a species of some kind of a jury nullification? Do what you think is right. Don't listen to the charge.
It is like nullification to the extent that you're inviting the jury to use their verdict to send a message, as opposed to
send
using
a message to who? Society or the defendant being charged with the crime? What message and who to?
Well, the nature of both golden rule arguments and social contracts is that you're making the jury take on the role of sending a message. And the message goes to the society as a whole, it goes to the criminal justice system, and it certainly goes to the defendant as well. But what it does is deflects the burden of the jury deciding the facts in a neutral and fair way by applying the law. And
so it's something else. Hold the defendant accountable, find him guilty of the charges that he's been charged with. Is that a violation? Is that a...
That's not what he's done. If it was just that, Judge, then you got me. But it wasn't that. He brings in justice to that in order to send a just verdict. And he ties that in, he marries that in with social contract. And now you have something different than saying murder is bad. And murder is bad, and in order to do a just verdict, you have a social contract out there. And that isn't even the worst of the misconduct. The worst of the misconduct deals with bringing that poor child who's dead, I'm sorry, whose mother is dead and now has no mother, and then arguing that what the mother did with her words as she was getting rescue had some relevance to the jury other than pulling on the heartstrings of the jurors.
Didn't the defense argue that there was some significance to her inability to identify Gleaton as the shooter?
The defense made arguments that the decedent was unable to identify, even though when she was going to die, the defendant as the person that killed her. And it's from that that the prosecutor perhaps launched or springboarded into his comments. At least that's what the prosecutor says when he starts talking about his justification for going into this realm of summation. But he goes so much further than that. You know, dying hard, the last purposeful conduct, I am done with my time, or may I complete?
You may finish.
Okay. The comments were dying hard, dying painfully. She had one thing in her life she would have liked to have clinged on to, even if she was dying. It's just as likely, objection, overruled. This is tugging at the heartstrings of the jury and appealing to the emotions. And then he explains what he explains. And then he continues, as she was dying, as she was dying hard, as she was thinking of her son, maybe she was trying to protect her son. Maybe she recalls that the door had been broken. Maybe she recalled one she loved, and maybe she wanted to get her last words out. Maybe whatever thought process she had, she wanted to die with some nobility and some sense of purpose. And the problems with that is that it's just irrational. You know, Haley Christensen didn't lie about who killed her because she was worried that Mr. Gleaton was going to come back into the house. That makes no sense. If she wanted to protect her son, she would have told the cops who did it. And so that was the error. I regret I'm out of time. I would have loved to have talked about Professor Leonard's analysis of why the failure to move for a mistrial should be reconsidered by this court since its holdings in 1955, which he says was an erroneous holding, or at least implies that it was. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. And before I get started, I just want to quickly respond to something that Mr. Cordes said, and if I misunderstood him, I apologize. But to the extent he's suggesting that PennLink creates any sort of data, it does not. PennLink is basically a mapping program, and it creates a visual depiction of the raw data in the Verizon records, which, so when you're looking at those slides that were admitted in evidence and you see the white dialogue box, that is the raw data from the Verizon records. The map is simply a visual depiction of it. And as you suggested, I think a lot of that is probably, well, we don't know all of the programming, excuse me, that goes behind that. I'm assuming that a lot of that is just plain old math. And they get the Omaha database, they know the longitude and latitude of all of the towers, they know the addresses, they just plot all of that on Google Maps, and then they just determine the math from the RTT data, which again is generated by Verizon. And I'm not sure how that calculation works either, but you know, apparently they have some means of doing it, and it appears to be accurate, given Investigator Hurley's testimony. With that out of the way, Gleaton claims the district court erred by admitting unreliable testimony, overruling his objections to the prosecutor's comments during closing arguments, refusing to redact certain victim impact statements from the PSI, and engaging in misconduct at sentencing. The state submits these claims are without merit. Gleaton first claims the district court erred by finding Hurley's testimony about RTT data was unreliable. I disagree. The evidence presented at the Daubert hearing showed that RTT data has been used in several criminal cases in Nebraska, and in each case it either corroborated existing evidence or led to the discovery of additional evidence. The same is true here. For that reason, the district court did not err in admitting Hurley's testimony. But even if it did, the error was harmless, since the tower and sector data alone, which Gleaton conceded was reliable, showed the movement of the phones during the relevant time period and placed Gleaton near Haley's residence at the time of the murder. To the extent Gleaton claims the RTT data was critical to a finding of premeditation, I again disagree. There was ample evidence to support, or excuse me, there was ample evidence apart from the RTT data that showed that Gleaton intended to kill Haley, including the harassing phone calls, his trip from Sioux City to Norfolk in the middle of the night, followed by multiple connections to a cell tower near her house, parking in the alley to avoid being seen, entering the residence with a loaded gun and shooting her in the chest where her vital organs were located, a Snapchat video, Gleaton's statements to several of his friends, and of course his confession to Detective Siefker, which included the poking the bear comment. That evidence, viewed collectively, easily supported his conviction for first-degree murder. Gleaton next claims the district court erred by overruling his objections to two of the prosecutor's comments during closing argument. However, he waived those claims by failing to move for a mistrial, but even if he didn't, both are without merit. The first statement merely advised the jury that murder is against the law, and its job was to determine whether Gleaton broke the law, which was true. The second statement was both invited by defense counsel and supported by the evidence, but even if the comments were improper, they were undoubtedly harmless given the overwhelming evidence of Gleaton's guilt. Gleaton next claims the district court erred by refusing to strike certain victim impact statements from the PSI. However, his argument on appeal is different than the argument he made to the district court. Consequently, that issue is not properly before you. However, two things are worth noting here. One, this court has repeatedly declined to exclude victim impact statements from persons who are not defined or statutorily defined as victims. Gleaton has provided no compelling reason to revisit those decisions. And two, while the district court agreed not to consider certain information in the victim impact statements, it was not obligated to do so. The substantive limitation that Gleaton sought to impose on those statements applies only in capital cases. This is not a capital case, so there was no error. And finally, Gleaton claims the district court committed misconduct by using him as a prop sentencing to placate audiences in the courtroom, or placate the audience in the courtroom. I disagree. As a preliminary matter, I've had several appeals from this judge over the years, and I can tell you from my personal experience that he often questions defendants before imposing a sentence, as he did here. I mean, I've seen him do it before, and in cases far less significant than this one. But that said, as for the merits, Gleaton did not cite any authority, nor am I aware of any that prohibits courts from questioning a defendant about the contents of a PSI in which the defendant participated. And as this case illustrates, the district court was able to obtain additional information from Gleaton when he disputed certain items in the PSI. And as for his claim that the district court violated his right to remain silent by asking him why he shot Haley, again, I disagree. Although Gleaton did not enter a plea or testify at trial, he confessed repeatedly to multiple people, and his confession was corroborated by other evidence. District court simply afforded him an opportunity to explain why he did it, to show some contrition, but he declined, as he was entitled to do. District court then relied on his admissions in the record to determine an appropriate sentence, as it was equally entitled to do. There was no judicial misconduct. And as for the state's assertion of plain error regarding credit for time served, I will submit that issue on the brief.
Going back to the RTT issue,
sure.
Where do we see in the record that the tower and sector data from Verizon sort of confirmed the whereabouts of the cell phones even without the use of PinLink? How do we draw that conclusion? That's what I understood you to say.
Well, no, because what they do is they import the PinLink. The way the program functions is that they use a Google map, and then what they do is they take the raw data, which has the longitude and latitude of the towers, and then they have the RTT data, which calculates the distance from the tower. And so it just overlays that onto a Google map. And so the raw data came from the phone records, and this is one of those cases where I don't believe that the phone records were actually offered into evidence. So we're basically going off of Hurley's representations of what that data showed and like the dialogue boxes. But when you look at those dialogue boxes, you get sector and tower information. You also get the address of the particular tower. So if you go through and look at those, you can see that he's bouncing off the same tower. Like, just for example, if you take the time when she went home, we know she went home right around 4 o'clock. She got there right around 4 or 5 or so. Her last contact or RTT data to the tower showed that she was on Sector 3 on the East Omaha tower.
So the tower and sector data without the PinLink mapping may give us an indication of the area they're in that's less precise because we don't have the time it takes to bounce off?
Sure. The RTT data, basically, with tower and sector data, which you get all the time, that's non-controversial. It's been admitted everywhere, essentially. That just gives you, PinLink displayed that before Hurley's ingenuity in the Loof investigation. They just displayed it as a pie. They would take the sector and they would show it or display it as a pie-shaped wedge. And so the theory is that, well, the defendant could be anywhere within this 120-degree sector. What RTT data does is tell you how far within this sector the defendant was from the tower at the time.
So instead of a pie, it's the thin arc.
Exactly. And so you get an arc, and that can be, it's more precise, but you still have the overarching tower and sector data that puts you generally in the area. And again, the arc, while more specific, is still sort of a general location. And as he testified, I can't tell you who was holding the phone, and I can't tell you that the person was at a specific residence. All I can do is tell you.
And there's some margin of error in the arc even, right? That
PennLink built that in, okay. Right. They thought his method was too precise, and so they built in, and I'm not sure exactly how that was done, but it basically widens the arc a little bit, so it's a more expansive area where the person could potentially be located. And I believe on cross-examination, defense counsel brought out the point, I think he actually got a Google map and said, okay, well, we're looking at this arc here, and isn't it true that this arc actually covers several blocks and potentially hundreds of houses? And he acknowledged that that was true. And I will say this, there isn't a lot of case law out there on RTT data. Every major cell phone provider has some variation or some version of that data. They call it different things. Sometimes they call it timing advance. Sprint calls it per call measurement data. They usually send out that information with a disclaimer saying, hey, these are estimates. Don't rely on them. But like I said, everyone has some version of it. So there are a handful of cases out there that have dealt with this. And usually what I have found from my research, and that's at both the federal and state level, and there's a very influential case out of the Seventh Circuit from 2016, it's the United States v. Hill, and it's generally admissible. The cell phone data has been well studied, documented, the flaws are well known, and so as long as it's generally admissible, provided the expert does not, or it discloses the limitations of the data and does not overstate its significance. So if you come in, as Hurley did, and acknowledge that, well, here are the potential flaws, subject to cross-examination, well, I can't put him in a specific place. And I can tell you that based on my experience, this data has proven to be very accurate. But then, of course, you had the Verizon rep who came in and said, well, we don't guarantee the accuracy, but we say it's accurate within 5 to 10 miles. Well, that was inconsistent with his experience. But he still acknowledged the weaknesses in the data. And so I don't think there's any harm.
Was this admitted as demonstrative or as, what's the alternative, fact?
Well, I think the PennLink maps themselves were just offered as evidence. Now, there were some slides that preceded that were offered for demonstrative purposes only, but that was just general background information about how cell phone, or towers communicate with phones. And there was some, RTT was included in that discussion. So there were some slides, but I don't think, there wasn't a similar restriction placed on 115 through 136, which were the actual case specific slides that were used in this case.
The case specific.
Exactly.
So they're representing reported fact.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Not an aid to the fact finder as demonstrative.
Right. And again, I think maybe that was done in lieu of the fact. I've had cases where the prosecution has offered the cell phone records, and sometimes you have a three binder thing and it's full of
lots of columns.
Lots of numbers and things that you need a key code. And I think they just simplified it here and said, okay, well, we're going to have Hurley come in and testify about the relevant portions. He offered the slides. And like I said, the dialogue boxes are basically, that is the raw data from the phone records. It's just you have a visual depiction of what that data looks like on the ground.
Was it necessary to have a Daubert hearing in this case?
I questioned that initially when I was briefing this case. I wondered if, do we really need one? And there's a fairly extensive opinion that was written recently by the Iowa Supreme Court. It's called State v. Boothby, I believe. And they went through the whole and saying, okay, well, when do you need an expert and when you need a lay witness, can testify? And I think the general consensus is that once you have an expert or a witness who comes in and does more than just testify about what's in the actual phone records, if they start talking about things like how cell towers work and communicate and that sort of thing, that now you have ventured into an area where you need an expert to come in and testify about that. And, Hurley was qualified to do that here, and he has a tremendous amount of experience.
What is he an expert in?
Well, I think the cell phone communications. He built satellite systems for the Army. He set up these things in the battlefield, cell phone communication networks and all sorts of things. And then he learned, of course, through his work with the LPD that how to analyze phone records, and so he put it all together. And frankly, I think he might have been one of the first people that ever figured out how to use RTT data in the way that he has learned how to use it. And, you know, if you look back at the Loof investigation, which I know this has been before this court, and Boswell and Trail, and you see how it was used there. I mean, if it had not been for his hard work and ingenuity, they probably would not have recovered her body, or at least not all of it. I mean, it was remarkable. He deserves all the credit in the world for that, but I think that goes back. And he also, you know, drew on some of his experience as an accident reconstructionist in terms of trying to calculate distances and that sort of thing. But, I mean, it was really quite remarkable. But I think he's easily qualifies as an expert here.
Before you sit down, sure. Would you care to respond to your opponent's allusion to Professor Lenich and what that may be?
Oh, the motion for mistrial?
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I have, in all honesty, I have questioned that requirement in the past. I mean, it seems to me that if you object, the court just, you know, overrules your objection, it certainly isn't going to grant a mistrial. So, you know, why ask for it? But, you know, then again, we have similar requirements with things like motions to suppress and 404 evidence. I mean, you have a pre-trial determination as to the admissibility. The court has said it's coming in, but if you don't renew your objection to it, even though you know what the answer is going to be, you waive the issue. And to me, this is a slight variation on the same theme.
Rationale underlying all of those things to be giving the trial judge the last opportunity to correct his or her own mistakes.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it would be, like I said, I think it's the same rationale underlies all of those requirements. And so, you know, I mean, I don't have any strong feelings about it one way or the other, but I'll leave it to the court.
I guess I haven't read Professor Lenich's article, but apparently he takes issue with that.
Well, it's critical. I didn't go read the article myself either. I just thought, well, you know, that's the law. I relied on it. And I think it's analogous to certain other requirements that we have. And so I'm not going to, you know, just dismiss it as being completely irrelevant. I mean, we have reasons for these rules. And, you know, I just accept them as they've been decided by the court. So if there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, counsel. That concludes arguments in State versus Gleaton and actually concludes arguments for the day. So the court is adjourned and you are excused.